Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. I am a registered radio health evangelist. That means, according to federal law, I am not allowed to be within 200 yards of a school or a public facility, but I'm still a radio health evangelist, and welcome to Health Matters. This is the presumptive nominee replacement surgery show. We have been barraged by our friends wondering if there is some way to replace the nominees, I suppose that's an orthopedic procedure, Rick. I don't know. I haven't seen that done in St. Clair, but maybe at some larger hospitals, nominees can be replaced artificially. I'm not sure. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here, the silent Bob of Health Matters, at least thus far, from the University of Kentucky Communications Infrastructure Manager Rick Phillips, to tell you how to access us on the internet. Hey, Rick.
How silent do you want me to be? Right? Do you want me to say anything at all?
It's going to be a difficult show, ladies and gentlemen. We'll go ahead with
okay,
our first.
let's just clear the air here. I was late.
Rick,
I was late getting to the studio.
Please,
I'm late. I'm sorry. You can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. Moorhead State Public Radio's website. They're there. They're listed. You do have to find Health Matters in the menu structure. Pretty easy to do. Look at the list of shows. It's the more recent ones. There's a summary there. There's a link to the audio. Listen to it. Put it on a DVD if you still do that. Put it on your MP3 player. Whatever it is you do with it, you can get it right there at WMKY.org. After that, interact with Facebook. Join the fun. It's just loads of fun. Facebook.com/HM Radio Show, or jump on Facebook and just do a search for Health Matters Radio Show, HM Radio Show. There's several ways to find us. There you will find our fan page. Interact with us. Leave us a message. Drop us a note. Post something to the wall. You know, if you know Facebook, then you'll know what to do. And you'll be surprised that more times than not, you'll actually get some interaction. You'll get some response. We like to interact with our listeners. So certainly suggest some show topics. Give us some feedback. What did you like? What did you not like? What do you want to hear about? What do you don't want to hear about? You know, it's all right there. It's your chance to interact with Health Matters on Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
And take a look. About a week ago, I posted a super slow motion video of a sneeze. It is one of the
grossest.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. Turns out that the sneeze particles go much farther than originally thought. This was some scientific work for super slow motion sneezes, and they probably can make it to the air vents on the ceiling, and we did not expect that. Our sponsor for today's show, the 5 Key Behaviors for Chronic Disease Prevention, and their motto, Rick, if you want to stay alive, you'll need some luck and do these 5. These are 5 things that we've known for a long time, and this is really the theme of our show. We've known for a long time these will help you to live longer and prevent chronic diseases. As a matter of fact, they were published June 2nd, 2016, in the journal Preventing Chronic Diseases. This is the 5 behaviors were first determined back in 1982. There was something called the Alameda County Study in California, 5 key lifestyle factors for preventing chronic disease. Number one, Rick, what would you think would be the top thing you would do to avoid chronic diseases?
Not hang out with you.
Okay, that's number 4, but at any rate,
don't smoke.
Don't smoke. Never smoking. Never smoking was number 1. Regular physical activity, number 2. Drinking fewer than 5 drinks at one sitting. As a matter of fact, we recommend 1 for women, 2 for men. But fewer than 5 drinks at one sitting. Maintaining normal body weight is number 4. And 5, sleeping 7 to 8 hours per night. And again, it gives you then a range of things, both the things you try to avoid, things that you try to do. Some of them, for many of us, are relatively easy. For me, never smoking was difficult because I was actually smoking even when I didn't have a cigarette because the people around me smoked until we got the ban in place. On the other hand, both Rick and I have problems with 7 to 8 hours per night of sleep because we both wind up being late night. I don't think the fewer than 5 drinks is a big challenge for either one of us.
Nope.
Look at those 5, and they give you both some things to be proud of and probably something to work on for all of us. We'll talk more about the June 2nd findings about what percent of the U.S. population is actually doing those 5 in our next fractional portion. That's our sponsor, 5 Key Behaviors for Chronic Disease Prevention. First up, this is an FDA bulletin. We thought we should put it out to our Health Matters radio fans. The ZQuity, ZECUITY, ZQuity battery-powered migraine patch may burn your skin off. This is, as I said, relatively important. An FDA announcement, June 2nd, 2016. There is a a process known as iontophoresis. The idea is if you ionize a chemical on your skin, you can get more of it into your system than if you just simply apply it to the skin. So we're all familiar with ointments and patches that we put on, like nitroglycerin and some of these patches for blood pressure medicines. And everybody knows the scopolamine patch for nausea and vertigo and things like that. They leak a little bit of medicine in through your skin into your bloodstream. Turns out, again, if you battery power that thing up, if you positively charge those things, you get a greater amount in. And so they've got this battery-powered patch called Zecuity Patch, and it's got Imitrex, the migraine drug, on it. And once you turn the battery on, you get Imitrex into your system.
Do you put it on your forehead?
No. What was this called, the pain off?
I don't know.
You apply to your forehead. At any rate, well, that brings back, there was a year ago, there was a commercial that I could not stand.
You put the two electrodes on your ears?
No, but what you do, take a look at this thing, Rick. You know, when we say patch, I think patch is a misnomer. That thing is on
a pair of shorts.
That is on an attractive woman's thigh,
yeah,
and it occupies fully a third of the circumference of her thigh.
Yeah. I mean, granted, nobody's ever going to see it.
No, but... right. But it's
unless it's
there
on my thigh.
Yeah, and no one's going to look, but... it's got on either side of it, there are these big round patches, and I'm just guessing if this was an average size woman that these things are maybe 4 centimeters, maybe about 3 inches across. And in the center is the iontophoresis unit, the battery and the thing that makes the things positively charged. Now, this seems like, again, we use this a lot of times in physical therapy. They have plug-in units and so forth, and they can adjust the charge, and that's where the problem we think is here at Health Matters. This is not an adjustment thing. You simply push a button, the thing becomes electrified from the battery, and it starts giving you Imitrex for your migraine headache. According to the FDA, a large number of patients. Now, I'm sure you can imagine.
It's not a number of large patients.
Well, the question is, what would be a large number? Rick is back, by the way. I think he's gotten over that being late, and now he's Rick again, as annoying as ever. A large number of patients reported they experienced burns or scars on their skin, blistering, cracked skin, severe redness. Now, the company says, well, you can have what they call a minor reaction at the site. This is the exact words they mentioned. Most people have some skin redness after removal of Zecuity. That's on the Zecuity site. The FDA says, no. I mean, we're talking about blistering, cracked skin, which is a little bit more than some skin redness. According to the FDA, healthcare professionals should advise patients who complain of moderate to severe pain to remove the Zecuity patch immediately. And so it may be that if you try iontophoresis and you don't have control over the amount of current you're running through, you just run a certain amount of current through, they may have this thing turned up too high. Alternatively, it may be causing an allergic reaction, but for whatever reason, the FDA has its eye on the Zecuity patch. Now, here's the interesting thing, Rick, or me, there's many interesting things about this, but you go to the Zecuity website and there's not a whisper of this problem.
Of course not.
The FDA apparently is in charge of letting you know. Well, you know, all right, let's say you or I, we invented something. You know, we've got this really cool invention, and then we found out that large numbers of people were suffering damage due to our invention.
Wasn't it called Health Matters?
Okay. At this point, we need to go to our – what you're saying, we got to go to our Facebook, and we got to warn people not to listen. I was going to
claim – we can do that, or the FDA can step in. It's one thing or the other.
I was going to claim moral high ground, and you just yanked the rug right out from under me. Okay, fair enough. We and the Zecuity patch people apparently are the same type of slime here.
No, we're open. We'll tell you. You know, we're not letting the FDA tell you.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
I think that's what we're trying to get to. Wouldn't we feel some responsibility?
You would.
We do every week. We close the show out with 10 or 15 reasons why you don't want to.
Shouldn't listen to Health Matters. And quite simply, if there were that kind of damage, you would think, and it may change. At the time we're recording this, I visited the Zecuity website this very afternoon. And this is, we are now 6 days after the FDA publicly released a warning regarding the Zecuity patch. 6 days later, there's not a mention, a whisper, a link to that on
the Zecuity's
website.
They sent an email to their webmaster. I'm sure that they're just having tech troubles like most people. They're trying to get their website updated, right? It's not their fault. It's the tech's
fault.
Users
should be aware that there is a delay in getting warnings posted on the site of at least 7 business days. I don't know if, whatever the buttons
do. It's IT's problem.
Yeah, I guess so. Something else, speaking of things that don't work like they are supposed to, we've talked a lot about the human gut biome. You know, this is the germs that are present in your gut.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the big thing is, now that we understand a little bit more about DNA, we don't have to culture these germs and try to figure out what grows. When we cultured them, we got the biggest, fastest growing, strongest bugs. We did not necessarily get everything. Now we can actually analyze the DNA of your that comes out with your stool, and we realize there are germs in there we had no idea were there. So we're learning about the type of germs that live in your colon. And you've heard, Rick, we've all heard about, let's use probiotics, let's use lactobacillus, or let's use the bifidobacterium, and these types of bacteria, these beneficial bacteria, let's just load up on those suckers, and it will promote better health and regularity and all those things that they say. And yogurt is supposed to be the way to do that, but there are other ways to supplement as well. So this was a paper that was published in Genome Medicine, and they said, well, let's look at the studies and see if you supplement lactobacillus or bifidobacterium or other types of bacilli, if you actually get any improvement. They looked at how many? Seven studies, high-quality studies. They look to see if it changes, if supplementation changes the diversity of the germs in your colon, the richness, the evenness, or if these germs lasted after they supplemented them. They gave, this was kind of interesting, again, they are lactobacillus, bifidobacterium, and lactobacillus combined, or bacillus by itself, and they put them in biscuits. I would certainly do a study if they gave me
free
a biscuit.
Biscuits.
Yeah, free biscuits. They've got some bacillus in them.
What study did you get to get the gravy?
Yeah. Well, they have milk-based drinks. I think I'd rather have biscuits, but that's just me. And what they found with these seven studies, all these seven studies, they could not see a measurable change in the germs that were present in your colon. That is, they supplemented, and there was no difference.
So, I mean, this is something we talk about. I mean, in some cases, those germs, bacteria, whatever, they have to get there naturally, organically, through the normal process of being healthy, active, good-eating human, right?
Right.
There's nothing we can do to make this process, or it doesn't appear as though there's a way right now to just say, okay, I'm going to give you the perfect gut.
Right. And certainly you can't do it by just adding those germs in. We had the chief of gastroenterology at UK on this show. It's been over a year ago, and he made the point that you grow what you feed. So if you feed the cheeseburger germs, you can throw some lactobacillus in there, and those poor lactobacillus don't stand a chance. They will be slaughtered where they stand by the cheeseburger germs if you feed the cheeseburger germs. If, on the other hand, you pursue a diet that is rich in vegetables, has a lot of food diversity, a lot of color, it has nuts, it has those things, then those germs are going to grow. You can supplement if you want, but you really don't have to. You're going to grow the germs that you feed. And unfortunately, in the United States, we have determined we're going to feed a certain group of germs that have not served us well.
Yeah, a lot of our stuff is brown from the coatings. And the deep frying.
More about that actually in our third fractional portion. We're going to go and talk about what our diet is doing to us at that time. In the meantime, we've got some information on ionizing radiation in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. Please stay tuned.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the presumptive nominee replacement surgery show.
What's got you here? You're all giggly.
I wasn't sure you were going to start the second fractional portion. We had so much trouble getting the first fractional
portion. Hey, it's Silent Bob.
Our sponsor for the second time. Five key behaviors for chronic disease prevention. Reminding you, if you want to stay alive, you'll need some luck and do these five. These are five things that can speed you along your way to old age. I probably didn't say that right, but bear with me on this. On June 2nd, in the journal Preventing Chronic Disease, a guy named Yong Liu from Division of Population Health at the CDC and his colleagues published this study of these five behaviors. And they found out, they looked at 400,000 people ages 21 years and older in the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, we call that BRFS, and ask, well, which of these were following these five behaviors? And let's remind you of the five behaviors. Never smoking, that's number one. That is the single best thing you can do to prolong your life and avoid chronic disease. Two, getting regular physical activity. Three, drinking fewer than five drinks at one sitting. Four, maintaining a normal body weight. Five, sleeping 7 to 8 hours per night. Now, if they look at those 400,000 people in the National 2013 Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance System study, a third of them had a normal BMI, a normal body weight, if you will. Two-thirds were either overweight or obese, and that's That's about what we usually assume looking at obesity levels. But a third of them had a normal BMI in the BERFAS. Half of them got regular physical activity, which I thought was pretty good, actually. 63% reported no or moderate alcohol consumption. That is really something to think about. This was a study of 400,000 people across the country, and 63% no or moderate alcohol consumption. 64% slept at least 7 hours per day, and 82% were not smoking at the time of the survey. So in general, if you look at one thing, other than normal BMI, which was a third, the rest of them were 50% or greater, physical activity, moderate alcohol consumption, 7 hours per day, and not smoking. And again, the 18% currently not smoking, actually, that means, the 82% not smoking means there were around 18% who were currently smoking, and that's actually a little bit higher, 16% the latest study that I've seen, but this again was in 2013. Now we'll talk a little bit more about how many people got more than one of these five in our next and final fractional portion, but that is our sponsor, Five Key Behaviors for Chronic Disease Prevention. If you want to stay alive, you'll need some luck and do these five. Rick, it is time for our ionizing radiation quiz.
Ready.
And you would think to yourself, okay, maybe it is time that I used up one of my moderate drinks for the day while these guys are doing an ionizing radiation quiz. Because, after all, how much fun is an ionizing radiation quiz? Here's the
reason. Compared to the alternative.
Which would be change the channel.
Or a non-ionizing.
Radiation quiz.
Right.
Which would be even more boring. But the ionizing radiation, the reason you want to know this is you or someone you love may go to the hospital and need a diagnostic image, an X-ray test. Wouldn't it be nice to know whether that X-ray test might raise your risk of cancer? Wouldn't it be nice to know whether or not that X-ray test has ionizing radiation? So question one in the quiz is, what is ionizing radiation?
Okay, tell me.
And a simple answer. And Rick, the biomedical engineer, wants me to take the lead on this, which is perfectly fine because I actually have the answer in front of me.
Well, but I know you're going to get it right.
Yeah, but it is, again, there are many types of radiation, everything from heat, if you look across the spectrum, heat to visible light to ultraviolet light to X-rays to gamma rays. And as you go up, the wavelengths get shorter and the energy gets higher. Ionizing radiation has enough energy to bump atoms around and knock electrons off of them. And that level of energy also can cause some adverse effects for your body. So heat can certainly burn you if you come directly in contact with it, or if you use the Zcuity migraine patch system. But heat will not change the DNA in your molecules. On the other hand, if you go over to the other end of the spectrum, X-rays are very high energy. All right. And we all know that X-rays make your hair fall out. They can cause skin changes, and they also can lead to higher risk of cancer. So these forms of electromagnetic radiation, the higher energy ones, do cause problems. Invisible light, we know over a period of time, visible light can lead to sunburn. However, visible light is not considered ionizing radiation. On the other hand, ultraviolet light, which is actually the stuff that makes you have a sunburn, is. And that's the thing. When you get visible light, you also get ultraviolet light, which does. So UVA is on the very, very lowest end of what we call ionizing radiation. Still a lot of arguments about cell phones.
Yeah.
Could, in rats, that level of radiation does lead to some DNA changes, so it would be ionizing. In humans right now, we're saying, well, the distance is probably too great. The level is low enough that it's not a problem.
You know, more and more people are going headset. I mean, more and more people are going, it's fairly rare. No, I wouldn't say fairly rare, but you don't see too many people on holding their phone up to their ear as much as you used to, right? It's getting better.
It is getting better. Now, the one area where I'm very concerned about is there are teenagers, particularly teenage girls, who sleep with their cell phones.
Really?
Yeah. Put them under the pillow because, you know, somebody might call, don't want to make the parents up or anything.
Didn't they
like
hear
that.
The part about 7 hours of sleep?
Yeah, 7 hours of sleep, but that does not include sleeping on a source of ionizing radiation.
Or something that's going to ring and wake you up.
Well, yeah, there's that too. But at any rate, have a heart-to-heart talk with your teenager. And also, as Rick said, a headset's not a bad way to go. There are still, although the U.S. has not really accepted that that cell phones might lead to higher rates of cancer, the International Atomic Research Commission has said, as classified cell phones as a carcinogen. And again, it's about ionizing radiation. So that's the question number one. What is ionizing radiation? It is radiation that has enough energy to actually change the nature of atoms and also potentially to cause damage to the skin. Now, the next question is, what X-ray tests have, and I call them x-ray tests, what diagnostic imaging tests have ionizing radiation? And I'm going to give you some, and you've got to guess yes or no. So if you're riding along in a car, just don't close your eyes. Keep your eyes on the road, but think, ponder these questions and answer. First of all, does a CAT scan or a CT scan have ionizing radiation? Yes, it does. And of the people, now this was actually a quiz given by the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center to their cancer patients. And their cancer patients had almost all of them had x-ray tests to diagnose their cancer. At the MD Anderson Cancer Center, 35% of their patients knew that a CAT scan has radiation. But a CAT scan does have radiation, and it's a big concern because our kids are getting CAT scans when they come to the emergency room, and like the cell phone, except many, many times higher levels of radiation, over their lifetime, it may make a difference. What about a PET scan? That's a positron emission tomography scan. We use those a lot in, again, in oncology. Not so much, these aren't present in small community hospitals, but in the bigger hospitals. Is a PET scan, does a PET scan have ionizing radiation? The answer is yes, and 35% of the MD Anderson people said that it did. What about an MRI scan? No.
Of course not.
Because it is a magnetic resonance imaging.
Yeah, MRI. Actually, and Tony, most people don't realize there is actually a dropped letter on the front of it. Do you know what letter got dropped from that?
No. E?
When it was first created years and years and years ago, back in the 60s, it was NMRI.
It was nuclear.
Nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. And you didn't know that, did you?
Well, I remember it now that you mentioned it. Yeah, we used to
and
talk about it.
And we dropped the N because it just doesn't sound good. Plus, nobody really wants to have a nuclear test.
That's true. But the interesting thing is magnetic resonance imaging does not have ionizing radiation. And
Tony, you know how MRI works, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it pretty cool? I mean, most people don't realize what is actually happening. But if you have the time and you like tech, read about MRI because it's pretty amazing. And if you understand what's going on, you'll understand the dull thump, 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 thump. You'll understand the noise that it makes when you're in it. I could talk about MRI for like 2 hours. I think it's fascinating.
Rick, in his previous life, was an MRI repairman.
Well, I did a little bit of it, but I did have to understand how it works. And there's just something cool about taking radio frequency or a really big magnet and then aligning your entire body's magnetic poles.
Does not do well with pacemakers. Actually, causes tattoos to heat up a little bit, but it does not contain ionizing radiation.
So the answer is no.
No.
But you had to ask. And I am Silent Bob.
Yeah, I understand. I appreciate your restraint. General x-rays, a chest x-ray, an x-ray of your foot, ionizing radiation, absolutely. 26% of the MD Anderson people realized that it had ionizing radiation. Mammograms.
Of course.
Yes, mammograms.
Matter of fact, they are a low KV, and they are very absorptive radiation.
Yeah, 18% thought mammograms. A lot of people thought, well, mammograms don't because that's a screening test. But in fact, mammograms do have radiation. It's one of the reasons why we've sort of pulled back a little bit on our recommendations on mammogram, because if you give a young woman yearly radiation, you can cause some mischief on farther down the line.
So here's a trivia question for you.
All right.
Or let me insert a non-medical one in there. What about your x-ray scan? What about the scanners at the airport?
The scanners at the airport, if I understood it right, they have it, but it is of a frequency that is very, very non-penetrating.
It is now. It didn't used to be. It used to be it was much heavier radiation.
So you got your skeleton burned out like they
could,
in the old
yes,
cartoons.
Absolutely. Long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But supposedly the newer scanners less likely to penetrate.
And that's why it was such a danger to your film, right?
Oh.
So it would actually irradiate, you know, film that was already exposed, you could ruin it. Completely. So anyway.
I had forgotten that they used to do that. See, your trip down x-ray memory lane.
there was a time in this world when I actually worked. I actually did technical work and, you know, I actually was, you know, understood
That was
things.
When America was great.
America
we
was
want
great.
To make America great again, and that's why we're doing the
Silent Bob
replacement.
Signing out.
Okay. Ultrasound.
No.
No.
Although, because it's not.
Yeah, because it's
radio
sound waves.
Frequency,
yeah,
but it's not at a high enough level of energy.
Right. So you've got now two negatives we want you to be aware of. MRIs and ultrasound do not emit ionizing radiation. CAT scan, PET scan, x-rays, just plain x-rays, and mammography, yes.
Tony, we have to say, over the years, what we have done from a technology standpoint is we are able now to use far less radiation to get the same or better imaging quality, so that the reports and the images are you know, so much more beneficial to the, both the patient and the clinician reading it, but the what we have completely reduced the levels of radiation exposure. And that's, you know, great for us. I mean, we've used digital technologies now to where we can use a digital pickup that can actually do better than putting it on film.
Fair enough. Then another one that I just wanted to mention, a heart catheterization uses actually a substantial amount of ionizing radiation, and only 4.5% of the cancer patients were aware that heart catheterization would use a substantial amount of radiation. Now, the next question, we'll stop here. Well, I've got a couple of things, but here we go. I want you to rank these in terms of the amount of radiation. I'm going to give you six things, and we'll rank them in terms of the amount of radiation used. Living in Denver for 1 year, you're going to be in the upper altitudes.
Right.
There is a radiation problem with that.
Right.
Taking a cross-country commercial airplane flight, you get irradiated there.
Okay.
A CAT scan of your chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
Okay.
An MRI scan of your chest, abdomen, and
pelvis. That's number five.
Yeah. Automatically, it's
six,
the bottom of the list.
Say.
Yeah. A mammogram, and then a whole-body PET scan. Now, one more time.
Denver,
commercial flight, CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, MRI of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, mammogram, and whole-body PET scan.
So here's the deal. Here's the deal. I would put the travel and the living at the bottom of the list. I would. They would be somewhere down there with MRI, right? They're at the bottom. I don't know whether it's four, five, and six, or six, five, and four, or what, but I would put them down. Am I right?
Actually, Denver was number three.
Because usually when there's that kind of radiation exposure, there's disclaimers. There's, if you have constant exposure like that in a healthcare environment, most people have to wear film badges and monitor their radiation exposure levels. So I would say if living in Denver exceeds what you would get by actually getting a scan, then the FDA probably needs to make everybody in Denver wear film badges.
Number one, highest radiation, chest, abdomen, pelvis, CAT scan.
That's what
CAT scans put a lot of radiation.
Well, and they
out.
Do this spiral scan where the it stays on. I mean, it just, you know, it's just pounding you. And that's why, Tony, we've talked over the years about people that come to town and want to do a whole body scan as a just a screening technique, you know, once a year. You're just getting such a massive amount of radiation that there really has to be a risk reward here. There has to be a risk involved, you know, that you can, you know,
solve a problem. Wasn't that many years ago, a Lexington group would sell you a whole body CAT scan as a birthday present.
Absolutely.
Without a doctor's order.
Right. Absolutely.
And is gone.
Right. And it needed to be.
So that's one, the CAT scan. Number two is the PET scan.
I was going to say, anything that's got a body scan is probably going to have a lot of radiation.
Three's Denver.
See, and I would have put it four.
Yeah, I understand.
Because I would have thought it would have been behind wherever the...
Yeah, Denver's actually... four is a mammogram, so Denver's actually a little bit more radioactive than a mammogram.
But, you know, mammograms are soft x-rays. They're very soft. They're low kV, low kilovolts. They're just, you know, so they're...
Yeah.
They're
slightly below the mammogram, the cross-country commercial airplane flight, and then, as Rick mentioned, rock bottom, the MRI scan, which has no ionizing radiation at all. They ask people, would you like to know how much radiation you're receiving with your test? And we believe that's a critical thing. Half the people at MD Anderson, we would like to know how much radiation I'm getting when I get a test. Actually, only 2% of them knew the amount of radiation, had been told the amount of radiation.
But Tony, don't you think that's a Pandora's box? And you think that's the reason we don't do it is because while I can mathematically calculate the exposure that I emitted from the tube head of the x-ray machine, I can tell you what left the tube head. What I have a harder time doing is tell you what your body absorbed. Right, because everybody absorbs different, right? So, you know, that's why we have X-ray techs. They set up the machines to work with the appropriate body types, the body styles. So, I mean, everybody is different, and there's no real way for me to tell you how much exposure you got.
True.
I can tell you what I sent, but there's no question as to what you absorbed.
That's why if you look at the people who work in a radiology department, they have badges to see how much they got rather than just totaling up the number of procedures they attended.
You had to wear a badge for years, didn't you?
I actually didn't because I wasn't down there enough. I would lead a gown when I went in, and I was not working there regularly.
I wore a film badge for almost 15 or 16 years.
Yeah.
because we worked with what they call C-arms a lot, right? And so the C-arms are taking the x-ray into surgery so that you can do fluoroscopy, which is a real-time view, right?
Yeah.
So you can actually
you just take an x-ray picture of where you are.
It's
continuous.
Yeah. You turn on the x-ray, you look at what makes it through the body on a little image intensifier, they call it, and it creates a nice little image to look at for the physician.
Next question, what are the risks from a CAT scan of the abdomen and pelvis? Pick all the risks that apply. Answer number one, there is no risk. Two is cancer. Three is radiation sickness. Four, sterility. Five, cataracts. And six is mutations that you might pass on to your children. This was an interesting one to me. The answer is cancer.
Right.
That is the answer. You will not get radiation sickness from a CAT scan. It will not make you sterile or cause cataracts. It will not affect your children, but you can get cancer with about a 20-year delay. And this is what makes x-ray screening for people in their 50s and 60s very palatable, because the 20-year delay means that they may get cancer after they die, which is very acceptable to all of us.
Right.
On the other hand, if you start running these CAT scans and these different tests on people in their
30s
or younger, then there is a real and defined risk. It's about 2%, I believe, lifetime a risk of developing some type of cancer from the scan itself. And again, depending on the amount you're exposed to. But if you did annual CAT scans, you can get in a serious problem with that.
Yeah, that's a case where you would only want to do it with the worst family history. You know, something that they, again, the risk-reward ratio is such that it is worth that 20-30-year risk that you're putting onto it.
And this is the sort of thing you would do if a child developed a cancer and you were trying to make sure that it didn't come back.
Absolutely.
But you have to rein your enthusiasm in, realizing that even if it doesn't come back, you may be causing a different type of cancer by getting yearly CAT scans. This is something, again, if you have a young person that is getting regular scans, radiation scans, realize the MRI scan doesn't carry the ionizing radiation, the cancer risk that a CAT scan or a PET scan does.
They're different procedures.
Right.
I mean, they're designed to look at different things. And
right. Talk to your doctor about the possibilities and be aware that radiation does not come, those x-ray tests do not come without some risk. And we thought that was, I thought it was a good study. It was discouraging that the people did not know these things, but we're not at all surprised. And now you, the Health Matters listener, you actually know this. Why don't you take that newfound knowledge into the kitchen, grab a cool beverage, and come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the presumptive nominee replacement surgery. Sure, there would be generally a lot of people willing to chip in for that procedure if we were to replace the presumptive nominees. But alas, that procedure is not recognized by the American Medical Association and Kentucky Board of Medical Licensure, so you're on your own regarding nominees. Our sponsor for the final time, 5 Key Behaviors for Chronic Disease Prevention. If you want to stay alive, you'll need some luck and do these five. These five things are: number one, never smoking; two, regular physical activity; three, drinking fewer than 5 drinks at one sitting; four, maintaining a normal body weight; and 5, sleeping 7 to 8 hours per night. Those, we know, going back now 30 years or 35 years, we are aware that those are good things to do. They are generally associated with a longer lifespan and fewer chronic diseases. Smoking leading to chronic problems with the lungs, lack of physical activity leading to obesity, leading to chronic problems with high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, leading to heart disease. More than 5 drinks in one sitting, leading to chronic liver problems and the sequela of alcoholism. Maintaining a normal body weight, again, once your body weight goes up, you get more likely to get diabetes and other risk factors for heart disease. And then the sleep, it turns out, there are several things. There is one theory that it may lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease, but most certainly it does have an effect on your appetite, helps you maintain a better body weight, and helps also maintain better brain function, we believe. So those are your big five key health behaviors for preventing chronic disease. And as we mentioned, a third of people had a normal BMI, about half got regular physical activity, two-thirds had a low alcohol consumption and slept well, and then 82% were not smoking as of 2013. Now, if you look at combining the behaviors, 1% of people had none of those behaviors. They smoked. They drank. They did not have physical activity. They stayed up all night, and they did not have a normal BMI. 8% had at least one. 24% had two. 35% had three. 24% four. And only 6% did all five of those things. Now, what that means is there's this massive room for improvement. The researchers reported the lowest prevalence of four or five health behaviors was in the southern states and along the Ohio River, which we are in a southern state along the Ohio River. So, oops. Unfortunately, yes, we do not do these things as well as others. And the highest, Pacific and Rocky Mountain states. Let's face it, if you're in Denver and you're getting all that ionizing radiation, you better be doing something right. They do have a reasonably long life expectancy in Denver. They are thinner than we are. They are healthier than we are in other ways. That is our sponsor, the five key behaviors for chronic disease prevention. Now, I read something potentially disturbing, and ordinarily...
Was it potentially disturbing or just plain old disturbing?
Potentially, and I'm still trying to sort it out. Yeah, sure. Let's make it disturbing. I read something very disturbing in the medical literature.
Right? There you go. Let's hear it.
All right. Preliminary data, and that's the problem. It is preliminary data. This is June 1st. This is the first
look. So it's relatively
new. Right. And they're looking at United States death rates. According to the CDC, their National Center for Health Statistics, the death rates for Americans has risen. Let me say it again. The death rate for Americans has risen. The general death rate for all Americans has risen. That means if you take 100,000 Americans, you line them up in 2014, 823 of them would die in that year. 823 out of 100,000 would die. It turns out in 2015, if you line up 100,000 people at random, 842 would die. In other words, we have gone up here by around 18 or 19 people per 100,000 in the past year. Now, again, it's preliminary, but I want to point out this is the first time it has gone up for the general population. We knew
we knew it was going up, though.
Yeah, for rural people, particularly for women in rural counties, the death rate has gone up. We were aware of that in previous years, but this is the first year we've seen a general rise in death rates.
But it's also a culmination of, you know, higher obesity rates, higher, you know, I mean, there's things that we're not doing a good job of as humans.
Now, this is what the CDC guy says. His name is Farida Ahmad, and I assume that is a guy, but it might be a woman. He is the surveillance lead. He said, it's unusual. And we agree with that. We have not seen that at Health Matters. We've been following these things because we're a radio show and we do that. It is unusual, but the data are preliminary, so I take it with a grain of salt. Until the 2016-17 data, we won't know if it is a trend. So the guy who was in charge of collecting the data takes it with a grain of salt. However, I will tell you, David S. Ludwig at the New Balance Obesity Prevention Center in Boston Children's Hospital at Harvard did not. He wrote a viewpoint June 7th in the AMA Journal. And it's called Lifespan Weighed Down by Diet, and he feels that these numbers are real. I will say there have been storm clouds gathering. A lot of people have been talking about the fact that life expectancy may drop for the next generation, and now the numbers are starting to come in that might show that. So I think he has kind of more of a global picture than the CDC guy. Again, these numbers may be taken with a grain of salt, but they may also be taken with a cupcake, and that may be the problem. June 7th, AMA Journal. Dr. Ludwig writes, since the end of the Civil War, lifespan increased rapidly in the United States, a tremendous public health triumph brought about by more dependable food supply, better sanitation, and improved medical care. In 1850, Rick,
1850,
life expectancy was 38 years for men and 40 years for women.
Some things just don't change, though, Tony.
Yeah. Some things do, though. And you think about it. I've really thought about this. If you had a life expectancy as a man of 38 years as opposed to 88 years, you know, you shave 50 years off life expectancy. If you send a person into battle, they may only lose 5 or 6 years off their life expectancy.
Okay.
You know, if everybody else is dying around you at 38 and you are a 30-year-old, that's not such a big loss. It's
you're just a few years from retirement.
That's right. You're a few years from
death.
But
now, Tony, let's be honest here. Wasn't the death rate or this number was skewed heavily by infant mortality, right?
It was.
I mean, back in 1850, infant mortality was so high that you either, you know, zero versus, I mean, it really pulls the average down.
It really does. And you know that because there were large families just to have enough children who survived to adulthood. So we're aware of that. That was 1850, life expectancy 38 years for men, 40 years for women. Good point, Rick.
It'd be interesting to see if they could take out the infant mortality, but I'm sure that wasn't tracked.
Right. 1980, Fast forward from 1850 up to 1980. 130 years later, the life expectancy went from 38 years for men to 71, and for women, it went from 40 to 78. With the start of the obesity epidemic in the late 1970s, the trend began to slow. Some people felt that it would reverse by the mid-21st century. That's what we were all expecting. According to the CDC, death rates for the first 9 months of 2015 increased significantly compared with 2014. The mortality rates increased in 1 year, 1% for heart disease, 1% for diabetes, 3% for liver disease, and that's probably due to the epidemic we have now of hepatitis C because of IV drug use back in the 60s, 4% for stroke, 19% for Alzheimer's disease. That may be due to better diagnosis, it may be due to a higher age population. It is not due to the fact, as best we can tell, that Alzheimer's disease is rapidly increasing in its prevalence in younger age people. He says the data are preliminary. They could change, but potentially they signal a looming social and economic catastrophe. So there it is, a social and economic catastrophe, and we have so many catastrophes to deal with now. We'll just add one more. But I thought we ought to talk about this and break it down a little bit in the time we have remaining. When he talks about social and economic catastrophe, see, we've talked about chronic disease. That's been our sponsor. If, in fact, we are pursuing health habits, they have become serious enough that our medications, that our cholesterol medicines, our blood pressure pills, we can't handle those changes we've made in our lifestyle over the past 10 or 20 years. At that point, then, this is going to weigh in the entire society down. He says, the counties that showed the relative or absolute declines in life expectancy corresponded closely to those most severely affected by the obesity epidemic. That is, people. Counties in the Southeast and Midwest. And where the fat people are, that's also where the life expectancy has the greatest drop. Modern medical care, says Dr. Ludwig, may prevent premature death if you develop obesity at age 45 and diabetes at age 55. But what about if you're obese as a child? See, we're going into uncharted waters. Right. Not our obesity now. People are getting obese at an earlier and earlier age. They spend more and more of their life as obese persons, and that is going to cause us some trouble. $190 billion annually lost due to direct medical costs associated with obesity.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you've got what happens. Obviously, you've got the diabetes, the heart disease, the high blood pressure, and those things. You've also got higher rates of knee replacement surgery. You've got the gastric bypass surgery, the other conditions that that people who are obese have in more frequently, and also they have a longer recovery time. And also, if an obese person wears out their knees, the cost to society for rehabilitation, for disability, and so forth is so much higher than the smoker's cost when they got COPD because they got COPD right later on in life. So it was a big deal. For years, the public health approach, this is Ludwig again, and this is where I got to it. I'm not sure about his numbers, but he has an interesting take on this. The public health approach to obesity has been based on the notion that all calories are alike, and what you need to do is eat less and be more active. I mean, you've heard that over and over again. He says, no, but if all calories are alike, then you could go ahead and drink all the sugary beverages you want and unhealthy foods. As long as you just cut back on the other stuff, you would not be obese. I mean, you may not be healthy. You may not have a balanced diet, but you wouldn't be obese. He references some of his own dietary work, and then he comes up with some conclusions. And I thought these would be interesting enough for us to talk about in our third and final fractional portion.
And it is our third and final fractional portion.
First of all, he mentions, you know, there are a lot of hands in the cookie jar right now regarding obesity research.
No pun intended.
That's correct. And these are things like the Mars Company, which is sponsoring research into the health benefits of chocolate. Both Coca-Cola and Pepsi have sponsored research trials regarding weight loss. And those trials tend to be more biased in terms of exercise and less in terms of beverages and junk food than the trials that were not funded by them. So there is this sense that if these are the funding agencies for our diet, they are going to fund research that shows that their products are good for our diet. He says, now that we've gotten rid of trans fats, and I think trans fats are a thing of the past, highly processed carbohydrates, and read that as sugars and the sugar substitutes, sugar equivalents, added sugars, are the most harmful components of our diet, says Ludwig. And, you know, Gene, we talked about that, and we now have the ability to track those in our food labels. Sensible reforms involving taxes, subsidies, and national nutritional assistance programs could make these investments worthwhile. And this is something, you know, we've tried in several cases to put a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages.
Right.
The beverage industry has heavily funded the opposition, and these have uniformly, well, I think Berkeley may have passed one, but New York, San Francisco, and one other area that escapes me have all funded, have put voter referenda or
other issues on the ballot, and those measures have been defeated. We do not have taxes on these soft drinks.
And New York was one of the trans fat leaders, right? They're the ones who managed to get that regulated before the rest of the country was doing it.
Yeah. And Ludwig says, we need national policies that shift away from low-quality commodities like corn and wheat and encourage high-quality proteins, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and other whole foods. We need to actually encourage these things. And right now, our agricultural subsidies, our advertising, everything is built around the stuff that really is not that good. His fifth recommendation, children must be protected from predatory advertising. First Amendment, says Ludwig, does not protect the right of food companies to market unhealthful products to minors. And, you know, we've talked about that before. There are places where you can't advertise sugary cereals or sugary beverages. But if you go to the Saturday morning TV, you will see all sorts of products that are not good for your kids being advertised for your kids.
Right.
And we have clowns and we have cartoon characters.
Cute little rabbits.
But at any rate, those are directly advertising, getting sugary products to our children. And he says they need to be protected. Healthcare professionals can model healthful behaviors. Thank you very much. And dedicate time to discuss diet.
Tony, have you ever modeled anything?
I have not modeled anything. Thank goodness. In addition, he says citizens can vote in two ways. And here we are as the presumptive nominee recommending for our citizens to vote with a ballot for politicians who place priority on food policies. Now, the thing is, you know, our medical system right now, we have all these things we're loading onto it. We have people who are going to be chronically ill, have disabilities, going to need long-term medical care. And at the same time, we're draining resources away from the things that could prevent this. That is, he mentions support. We could support better food. We could support our school systems and educating people. Well, you know yourself, in the state of Kentucky, we're pulling money away from the school system now.
Right.
And this is the catastrophe that he speaks of. If we have large numbers of people with chronic disease, they're going to eat up so much of our tax revenues, they're going to eat up so much of our GDP that, in fact, we won't have any money to fund our schools and to fund the efforts to get us out of this mess. So it is like a death spiral, and it is a very much literally a death spiral that he warns us about. So one, we can vote with a ballot, and then secondly, we can purchase food that is healthy, and that, of course, rewards the part of the food industry that's making healthy products. He makes a strong point for it, but in fact, I guess I am somewhat pessimistic. We reported this actually last June of 2015. The Los Angeles Times, they reviewed a article from the journal Circulation, and as best we can tell, about 25,000 deaths in the U.S. each year are linked to sugar-sweetened beverages. If you assign a relative responsibility of sugar-sweetened beverages to the deaths due to diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, and
you have to dig back to find out that they were heavy in sugary sweets,
right,
or sugary drinks,
right, and so and that can be argued, obviously, and the soft drink industry would argue it vigorously. Here's the thing: Mexico had the world's highest per capita consumption of sweetened drinks. The U.S. has the second highest, and they put a tax on sugar sweetened drinks. And that tax, in fact, worked. They have dropped their rates of sugar-sweetened drinks overall by around 4%, and within poorer families by around 9%, they lowered their rate of consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. Now, will that have an impact on their obesity rate and their death rate? Well, we don't know yet. The tax was passed in 2014.
And you and I may never know.
Yeah. We may very well not. But the point is,
in 1850, we certainly wouldn't have found out.
Yeah, we wouldn't have time to find out. The point is, we want to make people aware. This really, these trends are looming here. It looks like we're reversing our continuing rise in our life expectancy, and we think there are some things in place that are driving this. We have the ability, but we're going to have the courage to allow our government institutions to institute taxes or to do other things that help us modify our behavior. Otherwise, we just let the food companies prey on our kids, introduce them to bad foods, and the cycle repeats itself, ever increasing the amount of money we have to spend on health care, and no one is satisfied with that. Speaking of things you're not satisfied with, how about we take Health Matters off the air?
Special thanks to our summer Morehead State Public Radio producer, Tanner Boyd, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
your migraine doesn't wait, and neither should you. Health Matters is not a pill. It's the first and only radio system designed to provide relief from migraine.
Fight back with the press of a button. Health Matters is a radio system designed to be heard over a one-hour period to deliver information, the most prescribed migraine treatment, through your ear and into your bloodstream.
Do not use Health Matters if you have heart problems or a history of heart problems,
stroke, transient ischemic attacks, or problems with your blood circulation.
Narrowing of blood vessels to your legs, arm, stomach, or kidney.
Hemiplegic.
You should know that.
Thanks. Hemiplegic migraines or basilar migraines. If you're not sure if you have these, ask your healthcare provider.
Uncontrolled high blood pressure.
Do not bathe, shower, or swim while listening to Health Matters. Don't bathe whatever you do.
Health Matters can cause dizziness, weakness, or drowsiness. If you have these symptoms, do not drive a car, use machinery, or do anything where you need to be alert.
You should remove Health Matters before you have an MRI scan.
What are the possible side effects of Health Matters?
Glad you asked. So most people have some skin redness after removal of Health Matters. This redness will usually go away in 24 hours. Tell your healthcare provider if you have any side effect that bothers you or does not go away.
Oh, and by the way, FDA is investigating the risk of serious burns and potential permanent scarring with the use of the Health Matters radio system for migraine headaches. Since marketing of the Health Matters system began in September 2015, a large number of patients have reported they experience burns or scars on their ears.
A large number. The reports include descriptions of severe redness, pain, skin discoloration, blistering, cracked skin. As a result, the FDA is investigating these serious adverse events to determine whether future regulatory action is needed and will update the public with new information when the FDA review is complete. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.